This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear a talk from our own Michael Ratner, who spoke recently at the James A. Little Theater in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He was also in conversation with radio host Mary Charlotte Dumondi. The event was titled 10 Years After 9/11, War, Operation American Condor, Guantanamo, Civil Liberties, and Hope.
We speak with researcher Chip Berlay on the gigantic step backwards of our national security state.
What used to be illegal spying is now legal. We're all under suspicion, but especially Muslims.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We go now to hear a talk from our own Michael Ratner, who spoke recently at the James A. Little Theater in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He was also in conversation with radio host Mary Charlotte Dumondi. The event was titled 10 Years After 9/11, War, Operation American Condor, Guantanamo, Civil Liberties, and Hope. Michael is introduced by Mary Charlotte Dumondi, producer and host of the Santa Fe Radio Cafe on KSFR 101.1 FM, Santa Fe, New Mexico Public Radio. Let's have a listen.
It's a wonderful privilege tonight to introduce attorney and human rights activist Michael Ratner. He is the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York and the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights in Berlin. He's written several books, including The Trial of Donald Rumsfeld, Against War with Iraq, and Guantanamo, What the World Should Know. And watch for his two books coming out this year. One is called Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America. A new book also that is coming out is called Killing Che, How the CIA Got Away with Murder. He is co-host of the radio program Law and Disorder, which is carried by several dozen radio stations across the nation, though not yet New Mexico. So I've been reading and immersed in the work of Michael Ratner recently, preparing for tonight, and I've been thinking about how easy it is for a lot of Americans to forget the fact that even if you have a reasonably good constitution and plenty of good laws, you have to keep fighting relentlessly to defend them, and above all, to defend the least powerful people in a society, which these days seems to include an increasing number of us, for whatever reason, and I don't know, megalomania, fear, primate behavior, it's always a fight to gain and then to maintain the most basic rights and freedoms. That is what the Center for Constitutional Rights is all about. Now, as the adage goes that we journalists are taught, governments lie. They also spy on you. Since the 1960s, the Center for Constitutional Rights has been fighting a continual battle against U.S. government surveillance, break-ins to people's homes and offices, wiretapping, every kind of intrusion into people's lives, particularly those who express any kind of dissent. The targets of this surveillance are mostly those working for such subversive goals as peace and equal rights for women and for people with brown skin. Groups like Greenpeace and the Quakers seem to be a particularly dangerous threat. They were actually investigated by the FBI as domestic terror cases as recently as the last couple of years. Ratner speaks out through both his legal work and through the media, including his excellent websites and radio show, which you should all check out online. He knows that for every successful victory in court, there is a grassroots movement behind it, and that telling the real stories to as many people as possible is just as important as presenting great legal arguments. And he teaches us that any decent civilization is based on not just justice for the few, but justice for all. I think a lot of people don't even want to look at these issues because they're too horrible, and the feelings of rage and powerlessness arise in the face of these vast structures of firepower and money. It seems impossible to fight them. Here you have a person who is fighting and often winning and doing it with legal brilliance and with a sense of humor and deep humanity. Please welcome Michael Ratner.
Thank you all, and thank you for being here. And thank you, Mary Charlotte, who really sounds like she gave my talk. But I have some other things to say, but she got the picture right. So here we are. And I also want to introduce, I don't know where he is in the audience, the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights is here, Vince Warren. Where are you, Vince? Tonight, though, I want to focus really on one particular aspect of the center's work, and that's 9/11 and beyond. The reaction of the Bush administration to 9/11, which was creating what I would call the unending monster of the war on terror, and then where we are almost 10 years later, as the Obama administration, despite hopes, promises otherwise, continues many of the draconian policies that characterized the Bush administration. The wars, whether in Afghanistan, you can name them, you can count them, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, on and on. The Guantanamo syndrome, the group of issues around Guantanamo, from torture to indefinite detention, and then the attack on civil liberties at home. I want to talk about what the initial reaction was and what the reaction is today. And I can't say that it's a good picture. Not every cloud has a silver lining, that I can tell you. But it could have been worse. In some ways, we did see some people's actions, particularly around the Iraq war, where we saw tens of hundreds of thousands of demonstrators go out into the streets. We failed to stop the war, but at least we did not stand silent. And that's an important lesson, to get out into the streets and not stand silent in the face of things like the Iraq war. We at the center were able to win a number of issues around what I call the Guantanamo issues. We put an end, at least to most torture, as far as I can tell. We did get the right of people who were detained to go into court. We were able to close most of the secret sites. So it could have been worse, but it also could have been a lot better. And when I say it could be a lot better, and I want to say this to all of us, we should not be ready, really, to concede in this country that the world is best served by an unending war or unending wars, or permanent offshore prison camps and the cruelty that accompanies them, or drastically reduced civil liberties at home, or no accountability for the crimes of our leaders, or the utter impoverishment of the millions at home in this country and the billions abroad. So we just should not be willing to accept that that's the world we're in now and we've inherited. And so when I always think about how I talk to people about this, well, how do you change that? What hope do you have? And, you know, the hope, and it's a sincere feeling of hope and optimism that I have, and it really takes place in a complete unexpected way. So all of a sudden, I'm in Cairo last year, a year and a half ago, with my children who happen to be here tonight, and we're trying to get into Gaza with Code Pink. We don't make it in, but we did see the repressive Egyptian military and police in action. I mean, no gatherings of more than six people, you know, billy clubs out all the time, breaking up demonstrations. And then all of a sudden, you see what they're calling now, you know, the North African, Egypt, Mideast Spring, where thousands, millions of people have taken to the streets and are changing government and issues and policies in the only way that they really can make fundamental change, which is people taking to the street. And then you see it a few days ago, in Spain, no less, thousands of people jamming the squares. So I take hope from people's actions like that. I take hope from really even from something that hasn't grown to make the changes yet, but from the immigrant movement in this country, where people who have everything to lose, being deported, losing everything, stand up and say, do not do this to us. Give us legality. Do not do this to us. So I take hope. And I take hope from the people in Wisconsin. Again, who would have expected that? Who would have expected it? Here, they're pushing and pushing against the poor, against the working class, and then against unions. And nothing has happened for a long time. And all of a sudden in Wisconsin, they went too far, and 100,000 people gather in the square. My friends who were there in the 70s and in the 60s said it was bigger than any demonstration they had in that time when University of Wisconsin was, of course, a hotbed of progressive politics. In a way, we're in a very complex period, a period really of severe militarism and imposed economic hardship. But we're also in a period of tremendous hope and transition. And the outcome, good or bad, and I can't tell you how it's going to go, although right now, and how long it's going to take, but the outcome is not clear yet, and it may very well, if all of us get behind it, come out in a much better way than we've seen. So despite the talk that I'm about to at least give you on some of the issues that we've been fighting at the center, which are wars, Guantanamo, and domestic civil liberties, there's movements that cannot be controlled by the governments. And that's, I think, a really important thing for us to understand. I want to begin, when I talk about the monster of what I call the war on terror, I want to begin with that day almost 10 years ago, 9/11. I live in New York. I live in the Village. I live a mile from the World Trade Center. And I happen to be jogging past the World Trade Center on 9/11. At the very time the planes went into the World Trade Center. And I didn't see the first plane go in, but I looked up as I heard a huge explosion and balls of fire coming out of one of the trade towers. And there was no way in the world that I thought it was terrorism. None at all. None of us who stood at the side watching the devastation within the first 20 minutes of that building thought it was terrorism. We thought it was, you know, maybe a pilot who just missed or there's something wrong with the plane or whatever, but we didn't think it was terrorism. And as I stood down there and I saw another plane coming up the Hudson, and it sounds naive today, I thought that plane was coming to deliver water to the top of the building and put out the fire, or at worst to look at what was happening at the building. And then all of a sudden I see the plane curve around and go into the other trade center. And of course at that point I'm utterly and completely terrified. I figure I have to get home. My children are in their schools, two different schools down in the Village. What's next? Clearly terrorism. Is this a total attack? And I'm terrified. Where's my family? Where's my wife? Where's my brother? Where's my sister? Where are they all? And I run home, and over the next few hours spent, of course, some of the most painful that I've ever spent, watching the World Trade Center, pancake down. And the next few weeks, of course, seeing a city that was essentially a morgue, pungent smoke everywhere, you know, pictures on the walls of children saying, have you seen my mommy? Have you seen my daddy? Memorial services I went to with my children in the parks. It was an incredibly difficult time, extremely difficult. There was a lot going on already at my office, which I won't talk about in terms of roundups of Muslims and others that we were starting to do. But it was a time of tremendous mourning in the country, but particularly, of course, in New York City. There began to be talk of war. Within a few days, there was a lot of discussion. We have to go to war against these people, whoever did it. We have to go against war against the Taliban, Afghanistan, Iraq, wherever. And then Bush gave what I call his famous speech, the Crusade speech. I think you probably all remember that. It was a few days after 9/11. And I was completely shocked by the speech. There's one sentence in it that lets us understand how the future of 9/11 unrolled. What Bush said, he called for war, and he said, quote, this crusade, this war on terrorism is going to take a while. Those few words, let's look at this. First, the response is going to be a war. It's not going to be law enforcement. Secondly, it's going to be a crusade. And don't kid yourself, it has all the implications of Christians against Muslims. It has historical resonance and characterization that is deeply embedded in our Christian society. This was a crusade, and that is, of course, how it has turned out to be. And it was to be a war on terrorism, open-ended, unknown enemies, not a particular enemy, a war on terrorism. And it was to be without end. It was to take a while. So we have a war, a crusade, Muslims as its target, a war on terrorism, unending, and would take a while. My reaction to the speech, and my first reaction when I thought about it as I walked down the streets in New York, feeling the odor, feeling what was going on, My first reaction was, the last thing I want here is a war. The devastation that I've seen in New York, the devastation of thousands being killed, I don't want to see that on another country. I don't want to see us go to war and kill thousands and thousands and thousands in another country. That's not the way this ought to be. This is so horrible and so terrible and so dramatically bad and so sad, and it's the first time I'd ever seen anything like it, that the last thing I want is war. And then I thought about it, of course, as I'm a lawyer, I thought about it legally and politically. I thought 9/11 should be treated as a criminal act, and the perpetrator should be indicted, and then they should be arrested. Arrested with force if necessary, but arrested. I thought, try them, but don't start making war all over the world. This was not another country that attacked us. This was a band of terrorists that attacked us, and they ought to be indicted and tried. But of course, that is not what happened. We got endless war and a lot more. A current landscape that, to me, sitting here almost 10 years later, is almost incomprehensible. I mean, I was in shock at the time at the U.S. response, at the Bush response at that point, to 9/11. And there are three interrelated, what I'd call hallmarks of the so-called war on terror that I want to talk about. One is wars, just wars. And the question is, how many do we have? How do you count them? Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya. Where else? I mean, who knows where else? But 5, 6, 7. I spent my life growing up fighting against the Vietnam War and wanting that to be the last war I had to fight against. And now, with a Nobel Peace Prize winner in office, we're fighting 5 wars. And then the second aspect I want to talk about is what I called earlier the Guantanamo syndrome. And by that I mean offshore prisons, preventive detention, military commissions, secret sites, rendition, that's snatching people from one country and taking them to another for torture, and torture. And just for good measure, you can throw into that, or into any category you want, targeted assassinations, killing any person anywhere in the world. And the third area is domestic spying, including open season on religious and political groups, the lifting of all restrictions on FBI spying, wiretapping without a warrant, entrapment, especially of Muslims, and severe limitations on protest. I'm going to highlight a few of the key features of those three areas where the center has really led the crucial fight, particularly around the Guantanamo area. But the three areas are all related. They're not distinct. The more wars you fight, the more people don't like you, the more people get angry, and the more repressive you have to be toward the people you pick up in those wars. And the more there's dissent in the home country, the more you have to take away liberties at home. The three go like this. I mean, war, repression of the conquered, and then repression at home. And, you know, the speaker who was here last week, Chris Hedges, he gave really the best quote to me about this in a speech, the one when he was kicked off the stage in Ohio State, when he gave an anti-war speech in Iraq. And I always liked it, because he always talks about this relationship of these three characteristics. And he says, read how Athens, expanding empire, saw it become a tyrant abroad and then a tyrant at home. How the tyranny the Athenian leadership imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. And then Chris ends by saying, this, Thucydides wrote, is what doomed Athenian democracy. Athens destroyed itself, for the instrument of empire is war, and war is a poison. And that's what we're dealing with right now, today. Many of us, and I heard all of this stuff, bin Laden is killed, isn't that going to change things? Aren't we going to now get out of all our wars? Won't we change the issues of domestic repression? Won't Guantanamo close? Won't we end any kind of abusive tactics? And unfortunately, I doubt that bin Laden's killing will make any difference on the issues that we're talking about. And in fact, in some ways, some of it seems to be getting worse since his killing. I say that with regard to war primarily because the wars were not primarily about getting bin Laden or al-Qaeda. And that's really when we go back to how they treated 9/11. 9/11 was used as a pretext, to continue hegemonic U.S. practices all over the world, achieving goals that are more or less on the agenda before 9/11. I don't have to tell you, you know, especially concerning power and oil across the Middle East. It's obvious. If you're an oil-dependent nation, what do you need? You need oil. And that's why we are at war all over the Middle East. You also can't control, although we've reduced the number, you can't control and use 25% of the world's resources for 5% of the population of the world and expect that the places that are having the resources taken away are just going to hand them to you on a silver platter. They're not. You're going to need a huge military to get them. So bin Laden's death is not going to change that. And of course, Iraq is the best example of that. A war of aggression, a war crime, begun on the basis of lies about weapons of mass destruction and lies about a link to Al-Qaeda, a link that was based on information obtained by torture and that was touted at the UN by the war's most credible spokesman, Colin Powell. Now, when you think about how that war got started, and you hear now there's, well, we got bin Laden because we tortured people, because we waterboarded them, which is not true. And you see no one talking about the fact that we ostensibly got into the Iraq war because we tortured someone and he gave us false information about Al-Qaeda's link with Iraq. But some might say on all this, okay, Michael, you have all these wars are not really about 9/11, but that's not true about the war in Afghanistan. Didn't we have to stop the perpetrators of 9/11? And of course, we did, but we didn't need to overthrow an entire government to do it, the Taliban. And we don't need to continue to fight in Afghanistan and Pakistan today to do it. The wars, you probably know some of these statistics, the wars post 9/11 to fight terror have been costly. Over 5,000 U.S. troops killed, tens of thousands more wounded, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi, Afghani, and Pakistani civilians killed, $3 trillion spent on tremendous anger. And when you think about the hundreds of thousands of civilians killed, and you think of the almost joy in this country over the killing of bin Laden, who killed 3,000, 5,000, you could say, maybe more, and you think of this country, which went to a war with Iraq, completely unjustified, illegal war, killing hundreds of thousands of civilians, you have to ask yourself, where is justice? Where is justice? And I would like to think that there'd be an end to some of this. But I don't see it coming. I don't see it coming in part, and I'm sure you're mostly familiar with the Riverside speech that King gave when he talks about, I don't want to again form another clergy and laity concerned against the Vietnam War. I don't want to do that for future wars. I want people to understand that the Vietnam War is not unique. Until we get rid of racism, militarism, and materialism, we will be making war after war after war. And so with that understanding that we can't, even if we get ourselves out of Iraq, we're going to be sitting in this auditorium and marching against some war 10, 20, or 30 years from now. I also don't see an end to it because, and I want to get a slight bit legal, because there's a statute that was passed that got us into the Iraq War, and it's called the Authorization to Use Military Force. And if there's one statute, one piece of legality I'd like you to remember, it's that statute. And it's the one that's still on the books and still governs going to war today. And it's the one building block of the war on terror that is just essential to understanding what's going on. What it does, it's called the AUMF for short. It gives the president unlimited power, never goes back to Congress, to use force against anyone in the world, any nation, organization, person, associated forces, etc., who the president determines in any way was involved in the attacks of 9/11. There's no geographical limit. There's no time limits. You can use force in the United States. It's a power that the president has forever. Bush and Obama have interpreted that statute broadly. They've used its authority for war and detention, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Bosnia, Horn of Africa, even if nothing to do with 9/11. They've gone way beyond the statute. It is from this statute that Bush, and now Obama even more than Bush, claims the right to use targeted killings against suspects in the war on terror, even if they're way outside a terror zone. The center represented the family of the man named El Awaki in Yemen, who was targeted by the Obama administration for death. We represented him, his father, with the ACLU to try and stop that targeted assassination. He's completely outside the war zone. We were co-counsel with the ACLU. Unfortunately, we lost the case, but I still felt it was a critical case to say, test the president's power to kill, this man was an American citizen, to kill an American citizen in Yemen with a drone. But that power comes out of this statute. That statute, if those of you who are old enough to remember the Gulf of Tonkin resolution on Vietnam, this statute makes the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which allowed the war to go to Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, makes it look like child's play. This is war anywhere in the world. And now, in the face of bin Laden's death, in the face of his death, Congress is suggesting they broaden the AUMF. They no longer want it linked in any way to 9/11. They want the president to have the authority to essentially kill anyone in the world or detain anyone in the world who might be a threat to the United States, even if there's no link to 9/11. And as one of my co-counsel best put it, he kept saying, how do we know what the president's allowed to kill or go to war with? And what he said was, they know it when they kill it. And I think that's the appropriate way to think about the war power. I just think if we're going to get at the issue of war, we have to understand it wasn't about 9/11. It's about a lot more that's going on in this country. The same statute I'm describing, the AUMF, is also the source of unlimited war. It's also the key authority for what can best be described as the American Operation Condor. I don't know how many of you remember Operation Condor. Operation Condor is when Pinochet took over in Chile in 73, he had what's called Operation Condor. And it was kidnapping, torturing, rendering people from all over, particularly South America, but from all over the world, who were political opponents of the Pinochet regime. And it was obviously completely illegal, but it was looked at as one of the most despicable things a government could do. Pick up your political opponents, put them into secret torture camps, torture them, occasionally kill them, and then pick them up anywhere in the world. Operation Condor. And I call what came out of this AUMF statute, which is the detention part of this war power, the American Operation Condor. It's also what I call the Guantanamo Syndrome. And our first, I want to take you back to the first moment this happened, because it was a dramatic moment at my office. On November 14th, 2 months after 9/11, I wake up and I read in the New York Times that President Bush has issued military order number one. And I said to myself, what is this, military order number one? What does that mean? I mean, he's all of a sudden the commander-in-chief issuing military orders. And if there's a second key building block in the war on terror, it would be military order number one. And I'm still in shock over that order. It's still there. Bush had taken over all of the branches of government, and he's done so as commander-in-chief. And I still call it the coup d'etat order. What it allowed the president to do on his own say-so was capture or kidnap anyone in the world he suspected of terrorism. He could detain that person forever, indefinitely, never have to try them. If they're tried, he can do it in a kangaroo court, which they called a military commission. I called the kangaroo court. And there was no right to go to court to test the fact that you were detained. In fact, you were held incommunicado. It was going to be hard to get to you. But the writ of habeas corpus, which is the right to test your detention, was taken away. So you could just kidnap people, hold them forever incommunicado, solely on the president's say-so. With this order, I think, began one of the worst chapters in American history. But also to this order, there was incredible fight back. And in a sense, it's a historic moment, particularly for lawyers who gathered together to fight it back. And it's one of the most inspiring stories in that way. On November 14th, I went into the center, and I said, we have to represent the first person taken under this order. We may not know who it is. We have to figure it out. It's absolutely essential. At the center, discussion ensued. We were used to taking very unpopular cases, but did we really want to be representing people who may have been conspirators in 9/11? Is that something we really wanted to do? People like me and most of my office had gone in there to represent people we generally agreed with. We were not really pure constitutionalists. We represented social movements that were trying to make progressive change. And so this was fighting for fundamental democratic rights, but with people who obviously did not share our social vision of the world. So it would be something very different for us. And so there were people who were very skittish about that. There were people who were skittish about, of course, your fundraising department is always skittish about something like this. We're a small organization. A couple of big funders leave us, and we're done for, really. But we decided that despite it all, that abolishing the writ of habeas corpus was so serious that we had to take on the case. And it was debated fairly heavily, and we looked to the literature of our founders to see what they would have done in a similar situation. And we went ahead, and we decided to go ahead with it. And as Mary Charlotte said, we looked for help. We couldn't find another civil liberties organization in the United States willing to go forward with us. We found two other lawyers. They were death penalty lawyers. And, of course, death penalty lawyers are used to taking cases. You know, you go in and you kill a family in some town, and they're willing to stand up and represent the family, I mean, the killer. So we had almost nothing to start with. And as we began to get a bit involved, the hate mail just poured in. My kids were only 10, 11, 12 then, but the hate mail, some of it was about take your children, you know, to Guantanamo and let the inmates eat them for dinner and things like that. I mean, all kinds of really, you know, vicious, vicious hate mail. Hundreds of them poured in. These were very unpopular cases when we began. Doesn't look that way today, but when we began, this was really unpopular. I look at this really as one of the There's been many heroic moments for the center, but I look at this as really a watershed moment going forward, because we could have destroyed ourselves with it. As it turns out, it was, of course, the right decision. And just for a little background, Guantanamo is in southeastern Cuba. It was illegally, in my view, taken by the United States after the Spanish-American War. It's a long-term lease that both sides have to agree to break. So the U.S. runs this place as its little fiefdom in Cuba. And I knew about Guantanamo quite a bit. I knew a lot about Guantanamo because the center and I had represented the Haitians at Guantanamo when the U.S. set up an HIV camp at Guantanamo. And we'd eventually won that struggle after 2 or 3 years. But the U.S. position had always been Guantanamo is a law-free zone. The Constitution doesn't apply. No law applies. So obviously the reason they were taking people to Guantanamo because they felt they would be outside the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. And the idea that you would take people outside of a place where they had fundamental rights is extraordinary in 20th or 21st century America, much less the world. I mean, every human being has certain rights that give them a status and a personality. And the idea that they were putting people in a law-free zone with no rights was extraordinary. The people were held incommunicado. We did not know who they were. We finally found some of the names were publicized in the papers when lawyers or parents in other countries said, my son, I got a note that he's in Guantanamo. We eventually wound up representing parents on behalf of their children. Until we got to visit Guantanamo, the Guantanamo detainees never knew about us, never knew we were representing them, never knew we were doing anything. We were representing their parents. To shorten this part of the story, after 7 years, not once, not twice, but 3 visits to the Supreme Court, we finally won the final right for the people at Guantanamo to test their detentions in American courts as to whether they were being held there illegally. Now, when I say... when I say 3 times, you know, each time we won in the Supreme Court, the Republicans and with a lot of Democrats went back to Congress and changed the law so that we still wouldn't have the right to represent people. Finally, they had to say, it's the Constitution, guys. You can't change it. So we got the right to represent them. And if we look at victories, this was a huge one. The New York Times called it the most important legal decision in 50 years, referring back to Brown v. Board of Education. The right that anybody in custody of the United States has the right to test their detention in court. And the reason it's so important, it's something that, you know, in history you learn, it goes back to the Magna Carta. It's the right against the executive, that the executive can't simply, the king, the president, grab you by your neck, throw you in some dank prison, and never hear from you again. You have a right to go to another branch of government, to go to court and say, why am I here? What's the legal reason for holding me? As we went to Guantanamo, you know, we had heard when we started these cases that these were the worst of the worst. Rumsfeld said that. But of course, they weren't the worst of the worst. It turned out that 92% of them had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. 80% were picked up by warlords and turned over for bribes. It was all, you know, it was essentially made up. They were taken there, as the WikiLeaks documents show. Many people were taken there, not because the government thought they did anything, but they just wanted to interrogate people. So they interrogated a guy named Sami El-Haj, who was an Al Jazeera reporter. And they only wanted to ask him about how does Al Jazeera function, where are its bureaus, what does it do? I mean, this guy was sitting in Guantanamo for 5, 6, 7 years for no reason except they wanted to, the U.S. government wanted to find out about Al Jazeera. So we won this right of habeas, but, and we found out as we got to visit that many people, majority, should not have been there at all. So to jump ahead, where are we with Guantanamo today? I put a fact sheet outside that people should look at of what they can do. The good news is that out of the 700 people that have gone through the camp, 500 have been released. Most of them under Bush, due in large part to the efforts of this remarkable movement of lawyers, not just in court, but people who were willing to go out, speak, write, and fight for their clients. The bad news, and I mean it's very bad news, is that 171 people remain in Guantanamo. And I say it's very bad news because of our hopes about Obama. Obama, you know, I almost never support almost anybody for political office. But in this case, they circulated a letter for the habeas council, of which I was one, to sign to say we support Obama because he promised to close Guantanamo. So there we have this letter with all the signatures of all the lawyers saying, we support Obama because he's promised to close Guantanamo. And he did. He took office and he signed an executive order saying, I will close Guantanamo in 1 year. And of course, now 2 years have passed and Guantanamo is now a permanent fixture of our landscape. And it didn't need to be that way. Obama turned out to be extremely weak-kneed on this. And I'll just give you one example and move on. Some of the people at Guantanamo were what we call Uyghurs. Uyghurs are from Western China. They're Muslims. They were picked up in Afghanistan because China doesn't like them. If they were sent back to China, they would be tortured. It was admitted that they were completely innocent. 5 of those people remain in Guantanamo today. When Obama took office, we had a court order saying they should come into the United States. Obama said, I'm not letting them into the United States, even though the court has ordered it. I control entrance to the United States. And at that point, no Guantanamo detainees come into the United States anymore. Even these Uyghurs, who had a huge Uyghur community in Washington to take care of them, et cetera, nothing. And at that point, after Obama shows weakness on that, then, of course, our wonderful Congress gets into the act. And they're in the act, you know, they're in the act broadening the war authority. Now they're in the act, of course, on Guantanamo. You know, just for, I mean, as far as I can tell, it's for, you know, shots on TV. So they can't use any money to bring any Guantanamo detainee into the United States. Now they can't build a prison in the United States. Now this week they're trying to ban family visits. There's no family visits yet. Now they're thinking, because they now have a long-term detention facility in Cuba, maybe we should allow family visits to these completely innocent people. And now, of course, Congress is now trying to pass a law saying no family visits. We've seen a weak president, a strong Congress, and we see Guantanamo still exist. So now what we have at Guantanamo is an offshore penal colony with the cleared people who should be freed, with people scheduled for rum trials, and people indefinitely detained. You know, it's almost a contest for me, which is worse? Is it worse to be innocent and sitting in Guantanamo for 10 years? Is it worse to be scheduled for a crooked trial? Or is it worse to just be detained forever? The point is, all three are bad. We're a changed country. Most people don't seem to care, particularly here at home. And what's interesting, it was not okay when Bush was president, and it shouldn't be okay now that Obama's president.
That was an excerpt from a speech by our own Michael Ratner at the James A. Little Theater in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at the event titled 10 Years After 9/11, War, Operation American Condor, Guantanamo, Civil Liberties, and Hope. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Well, I'll live tomorrow. I just can't say you're right. Well, I'll live tomorrow.
There's a sprawling hidden world of surveillance organizations growing beyond control in the United States. 24 of them were created by the end of 2001, including the Office of Homeland Security and the Foreign Terrorist Asset Tracking Task Force. The next year, 37 more were created to track weapons of mass destruction and collect threat tips. By 2009, nearly 260 organizations were created as 854,000 civil servants, military personnel, and private contractors with top secret security clearances monitor national security concerns. However, according to a report from the Public Research Associates, those same concerns have bolstered a class of self-proclaimed terrorist experts who both scare and monitor the American people. Chip Berlay is a veteran freelance writer who specializes in investigating right-wing social movements and a public research associate staffer since 1982. He joins us to talk more about that report. Chip, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for having me.
I edited a book with Michael's help about Bill Kunstler called The Encroaching Police State. That was about 6 years ago. Seems to me that things have picked up really on the gallop here. We now understand that there's something called the security training centers that have been established. Talk to us about that, will you?
Well, it's basically as part of the Department of Homeland Security initiatives and working with the FBI and other aspects of the national security apparatus, and especially after 9/11, what happened is that there was a need to train thousands of local and state and federal counterterrorism, quote-unquote, experts. And what occurred is some of these trainings are actually quite good. And I've reviewed the curriculum of some of them, actually, that are quite good and are very careful to argue that law enforcement officials of any sort need to be not claiming that Islam itself is terrorist or, you know, violent. And the problem is that there's a handful of groups that train hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of local, state, and federal counterterrorism experts with rhetoric that basically is Islamophobic. It really is bigoted against Muslims and Islam and invokes ideas that portray Muslims as practicing a religion that, if it's practiced properly, is inherently violent. And this is actually against the official policy of the United States government. And yet, as early as 2008, there were online posts, primarily on a small website called Talk to Action, where there was a whole series of articles talking about these trainers, especially a guy named Waleed Shubat.
What did he have to say, that guy?
Well, Shubat claims to be a convert, and he's now a practicing Christian. He claims he was a former terrorist, although every piece of available evidence from his family and friends is that this is at best exaggerated and perhaps even fictitious. And he recently gave a five-hour speech in Las Vegas at the International Counterterrorism Officers Association training there, where he basically said that it is typical of Muslims to engage in a form of violent jihad in which rape, gutting, beheading, burning, and just general murder on behalf of the religion is commonplace. And this is on the basis of a source who attended that meeting. So we're not just speculating. There was someone who we became in contact with who was horrified by this speech.
So these are people who actually are training law enforcement in what to do about the, quote, terrorist problem. Is that it?
That's correct. And these trainings happen all over the country and on every level.
Chip, I want to step back for a second and get a little bit of an overview here. Since 9/11, I mean, you know, many of us would say we have a national security state. There's been an increase in surveillance. Just how bad is it? You've been at this since I've known you as a kid, really. Is this the worst moment in terms of our civil liberties, our right to privacy, our right to dissent that you've ever seen? And if so, even if it's not the worst, what do you see as some of the key elements?
Well, I remember sitting around having a few beers with you, Michael Ratner, and Bill Kunstler and Goodman and a bunch of other of us old farts who are worried about civil liberties. And this was before the reforms of the law and spy agencies, and COINTELPRO had been revealed, but there had not been any Justice Department action to sort of regulate. And as we know, in the late 70s, there was an attempt to restrain some of this activity of illegal surveillance and essentially disruption. And so I would have said previously that the late 60s, early 70s was a pretty intense period of political repression by government agencies. I'd have to say right now it's worse. And I'm not happy to say that. I'm very depressed to say that. But I think that what used to be done illegally and covertly is now done ostensibly legally and openly and, in fact, proudly by both Democrats and Republicans who should be ashamed.
Give us some examples of that, Chad.
Well, the whole nature of the local strategic suspicious activity reporting initiative, which basically is a pipeline for unverified rumor and innuendo through local police departments up through a chain of information agencies into the federal government. We know that in Europe, this kind of reporting is considered unconstitutional and bad for the society. During the FBI's secret war against dissent known as the counterintelligence program, we know that this network of public and private reporting from the local level up the chain carried all sorts of false information, claims very politicized, often not looking at criminal activity, but looking at the political views of civil rights activists, anti-war activists, anti-imperialist activists. Remember the famous FBI memo from J. Edgar Hoover demanding to know who was behind the women's movement. Angry women who were oppressed were behind the women's movement, Mara, not Moscow. But all of that was secret. People were ashamed of it. They had to do it in secret. And then it was revealed and exposed, you know, by NBC News originally, or actually originally by the people who stole the documents at Media Pennsylvania, which then prompted NBC News to file a Freedom of Information Act and disclose the COINTELPRO program. And then there were reforms. Now, everything that was considered illegal and heinous and unconstitutional and for which there were congressional hearings and reforms under Jimmy Carter, now we just do this publicly and openly as if it is not a national security state that we live in.
That's the key here. Acting suspiciously. I understand, Chip, that the there's a nationally coordinated effort to link local and regional police officers with the FBI in Washington. And that one statistic I read, I want you to comment on this, 890 state and local authorities have filed 7,197 reports on people acting suspiciously, and there have been no convictions.
Right. And this is through things such as the SAR initiative, which works through what are known as fusion centers, what are known as joint terrorism task forces. This is why the training is so important, because in proper training, which actually is looking for criminal activity, not people of color who, you know, wear garb that we're scared of. And that's really what's going on here. Let's be honest. First of all, what's going on here is untrained and badly trained law enforcement officers are reporting the names of people up into a huge infrastructure of information data storage based on bias that they have not been trained to resist and confront within themselves. So that a car full of Muslims slowing down in a neighborhood is reported as a suspicious activity. That somebody taking a picture of trains is reported and detained when Amtrak was holding a photo contest for pictures of trains.
That's great.
the kinds of stories that come out of some of these reports are, on one hand, humorous, and on many cases, quite tragic.
No, Chip, I was in Algeria years ago after revolutionary government was overthrown. It was a really repressive police state. I kind of innocently took a photograph of a black and a white lamb who were in the saddlebags of a bicycle. I thought it was really cute, you know, the black face and the white face of the lamb, and I took a photograph of it, and I was immediately busted by a bunch of cops. They took my camera. My French isn't so good, so I didn't realize what was going on. My friend came over to explain to me that there was a police station and a police officer behind the two lambs, and I had inadvertently taken a picture of the two lambs, and I got busted for it. My camera was confiscated.
Inadvertently taking a picture of the police station, Michael, not the lambs.
That's right. That's why. But that seems to me what's going on here.
Oh, sure. Look, in Maine, here's an example. Three men of who were described as of Middle Eastern descent were in a city. Basically, they were driving a van with Florida license plates, right? And they were asking if anybody knew about renting boats. And we're on the coast of Maine where people rent boats all the time. But actually, it turned out that that was the day that the Queen Mary II was going to be making a port visit to Bar Harbor. And thousands of people were renting boats to go out and watch it. So what was special about these three people? They were described as Middle Eastern. So where's the crime? And this is about bigotry. This isn't about law enforcement.
So can you give us some sense, how many people are in this, what is it, a registry, suspicious activity registry, or what?
Well, it is the ground floor mechanism by which local police and other law enforcement folks report up suspicious activity, quote-unquote, up through the chain of command and up through the infrastructure. So there are tens of thousands of people who are involved in this on the local level and the state level. We describe this whole process as a platform for prejudice in a report by Tom Chincotta, a National Lawyers Guild attorney that we published this year. It's so large and it's so complex that Tom on his wall has a wall chart of all the agencies involved in this information reporting system, and it has like 150 dots so interconnected that it's almost pointless to look at it. It's just, no one can control this, and I'll tell you, we've been asking, Tom especially has been asking folks up in the DHS and the Justice Department, do they know that this kind of bigoted training is going on? Do they have standards by which they approve people? Do they check those standards to see if they're being followed? And to be perfectly honest, a lot of the folks we've been talking to are genuinely saying, we have no idea how to even start doing that. It's a great idea. What do you suggest?
We were talking to Chip Berlay from Public Research Associates. He's been with that organization for many years. Chip, how do people who listen to Law and Disorder get a hold of you?
Well, I've been posting about these Islamophobic trainers up on Huffington Post, and it's pretty easy to find just by going there and looking for those articles. And then those articles have links to a lot of other resources, including in my first article, a link to the report Platform for Prejudice. And then January with a new report on these bigoted training groups.
And when you say "were," you mean the Political Research Associates?
Yeah, our website is publiceye.org. It's an old magazine that started with the Lawyers Guild way back in the 70s, but now we're publishing it. So it's publiceye, publiceye.org. And right on the front page, there's a link to our work in this area.
Chip, there's this, as we've been talking about, this nationwide suspicious activity reporting initiative called SAR. Their whole effort seems to be driven by what they call homegrown terrorism. And it's been my impression that this homegrown terrorism is really inflated and often actually organized by the FBI itself.
As many of us know, sometimes the informers the FBI uses invent situations that are essentially entrapment and encouragement, and they create cells of terrorists to bust by, you know, it's the guy who always says, I can get you the bomb, I can get you the C4. You know, and this goes way back to the Molly Maguires and the Pinkertons. So the idea that informers sometimes create threats of violence in order to get their paycheck is very old theory and been proven throughout history. And I think that's going on now. I wrote an article in the journal Criminology and Public Policy where I pointed out that one of the gurus of this area, Mark Sageman, has been using sociology 20 years out of date to make allegations about how social movements are built, how they turn to violence, that really have to be rejected. And it's his work that is used widely by law enforcement and intelligence gathering folks. One of the things he basically said that is that all social movements gravitate towards violence. Really? Really, Mark?
The one I'm in gravitates towards self-defense.
It's an outlandish statement, but it's a dangerous statement because whether you're on the right or the left, if you're a dissident, then you're a potential terrorist. And I want to challenge the libertarians, like the folks at Cato and other places, to step up and say, this is not acceptable. It's not acceptable against the left or the right, and it's certainly not acceptable against Muslims. And I'm hearing a deafening silence from my allies on civil liberties who are on the political right on these questions.
Any final thoughts? What people can do about all this? I know they can go to your website. What other kinds of actions can they do, or should we just assume that everything about us is known to the government and go on with our lives?
Well, I think we do have to assume that potentially the government knows what we're up to, but that historically the ability to restrain national security repression by government or private groups, it's groups in action, it's militant protests. It's building coalitions across political boundaries. On civil liberties, political boundaries are less important than enforcing constitutional law and the First Amendment. So I'm urging people to form broad coalitions with people across the political spectrum to say, you know, this is a national security state, not a democracy, and it's time to change things.
Chip Berlay from Political Research Associates has been at this for many, many years. Thank you very much, and I recommend, again, going to Chip Berlay's articles on Huffington as well as going to the website for Political Research Associates.
Thanks, Chip.
Thank you, Chip.
Guys. Great to talk to you. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.